Mode 6 above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war.
And welcome to this Monday edition of A Public Affair. This is John Quinlan sitting in for Brenda Conkle. Fascinating show coming up, something I've been looking forward to covering for quite a while, but especially in relation to recent events that have been in the news. That's a discussion of talking about the historical context for recent developments in the Korean Peninsula. And very pleased to be joined in studio by my guest, Charles Kim. Charles, welcome to Public Affair.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. And Charles is a historian of 20th century Korean culture and society with a specialization in South Korea after 1945 with the UW History Department. His research and teaching interests include nationalist discourse, collective memory, popular culture, and social relations. He's currently at work on a study that examines the cultural origins of South Korea's April Revolution and also just returned from a semester in South Korea. Is that right?
Yeah, I was there until just about 10 days ago.
Well, Charles, as we were talking about going into the program, I think one of the things that becomes apparent at the time of transition that's been occurring in terms of from the leadership of Kim Jong-il to Kim Jong-un is just how little context Americans have for the greater history of the two Koreas. I think we view North Korea fairly monolithically as a place of tyranny and perhaps sometimes demonize or dehumanize the people of North Korea itself. We don't look at the more complicated history of South Korea, which has both been a place of democracy but also a place that struggled to obtain democracy. And a lot of that, I think, is because of the lens through which we view that history, which is very much influenced by American foreign policy, how this country's best interests have or haven't been served. Let's start at a pretty basic place. We were talking ahead of the show about that in many ways this country has had a period of introspection about another important conflict that influenced us, the Vietnam War. But there's not necessarily a parallel understanding of the Korean War, is there?
Right. I would definitely agree. There's obviously been so many critical discussions and energies devoted towards thinking about the Vietnam War and America's involvement in it from the 60s into the 70s and beyond. In a lot of ways, the Korean War, there are a lot of question marks surrounding why we were involved in it, our own conduct, the conduct of not all of our armed forces, but certain incidents and certain unfortunate things that happened during the 3-year conflict in Korea that have not really had undergone the sufficient scrutiny and rethinking and discussion. And I think that a lot of things that happened and during the Korean War and a lot of the patterns that were set back then in the 50s or even in the latter half of the 1940s can go a long ways in explaining what's going on in North Korea today, what's going on in North Korea-South Korea relations, and as well as with our own relations with North Korea.
I should mention at the outset one of the reasons why this is an especially wonderful opportunity for me is that a year ago at this time I was taking one of your courses, History of Modern Korea. The emphasis there was on the post-World War II period, although we did talk about the influence of the Japanese occupation and other pieces of history there. I think probably starting, though, with 1945, in terms of filling in our listeners about pieces of history they may not be aware of, that was a time of transition. I think the story we have is South Korea became a good place, a place reminiscent, very resonant with American democracy. North Korea immediately took a turn toward being an autocratic Leninist society. But at least let's start with North Korea. That history of 1945 to 1950 is much more complicated and nuanced than that, is it not?
Absolutely. It was definitely one of the core messages when we were covering that in the course last year. I think that the basic narrative that circulates in America and is that America was saving Korea from a full occupation by the Soviet Union, that it was Soviet expansionism, communist expansionism that was that had taken over the northern part of the peninsula and was threatening to take over the entire peninsula. A lot of more recent historians of the past 20, even 30 years in America, those who seek to revise upon that received narrative, that standard narrative, have sought to show that that in fact a lot of the U.S. conduct and involvement in Korea coming out of the end of World War II and from the Korean perspective coming out of the end of the Japanese colonial era did a lot to actually create a division between North and South Korea that didn't exist and that really sought to resulted in creating greater cleavages politically between existing communists in Korea during the colonial era and more rightist nationalists that were also that also inhabited the political spectrum in Korea during the colonial era. So this is before 1945.
So Kim Il-sung, who was essentially the founder of North Korea, the modern North Korea, and was a military hero coming out of this, but he existed on the scene with a fairly diverse and vibrant multi-party political setup. There were parties of all different ideologies. I think in a way that we assume that he immediately took power, but it was a bit more complicated than that. In keeping with what you're saying,
it was a complex political scene in North. So coming out of the colonial era from 1945, we'll say 1945 to 1950, before the outbreak of the Korean War, there was a complex political spectrum in all of Korea, both in North and South, that ranged from communists to more moderate leftists and moderate rightists, as well as more conservative rightists. Now, in North Korea, Kim Il-sung definitely did a lot to consolidate his own power and to rise to the top of the heap among the leftists, among the communists. More importantly, and I think with respect to your earlier question, what the United States did and was very interesting about 1945 to 1950 and the case of the U.S. Occupation of South Korea, and this was definitely a military occupation, much like what we have seen in Afghanistan and in Iraq, was that this started a pattern in which the U.S. Backed rightist leaders in a country due to, at that point, early Cold War fears and concerns among U.S. leadership. And so what they did in South Korea was they backed some of the most controversial collaborators from the colonial era and kept them up in power or actually elevated their roles in the new South Korean society. Because they were deemed to be more trustworthy, to be anti-communist people that the U.S. government and the U.S. military could rely upon. And this resulted in more of a polarization, instead of a wedge between the leftists and the rightists, and it really skewed the situation, making South Korea really a rightist conservative political setting, and then really making the North more of a leftist communist setting that really began to center around the figure of Kim Il-sung, this former military leader.
You can stop me if I'm painting in too broad terms, but it seems like in some ways the South, from early on and through much of its history, American interest was in preserving stability, which often represented more the status quo. And so in this post-World War II period, it was supporting folks that had been part of the Japanese occupation of Korea that had collaborated. Whereas, and if we could contrast that a bit, then within the North, ironically, there the society was kind of turned on its head. I know that one of the things we learned about in a book called Long Road Home was that, for example, children who lived in orphanages were often held in a higher esteem and were groomed for leadership. And the folks that were complicit with the Japanese, at least in that viewpoint, were on the opposite end of the spectrum. We're probably at the bottom of society. So is that correct? That there was this juxtaposition of of you know, who would come into have privilege and have become the ruling elite was sort of the opposite in both countries. Does this make sense?
Right. There. Yeah. Definitely. I think on the U.S. side, a lot of the policymakers did not have much of an idea of what to do with Korea. Most of their intelligence efforts, most of their policymaking efforts were focused on Japan and what to do with Japan after Japan's defeat. Korea, on the other hand, was just sort of an empty. There was just a real dearth of knowledge, and in the case of Korea, they were foreseeing Cold War tensions with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union actually had very little territorial ambitions in Northeast Asia. Coming out of World War II, they were concerned with a lot of other hotspots in the world. So the U.S., they saw in these conservative nationalists the ability to keep things in order and have an anti-communist leadership in the peninsula. And in doing so, yeah, they maintain a lot of status quo. The Japanese colonial rule, colonial government from 1910 to 1945 in Korea, they relied upon a lot of the traditional Korean leadership to maintain the agricultural system, which was focused on the landlords, to maintain landlord-peasant relations in the Korean countryside, this sort of thing. And the North Korean leadership between 1945 and 1950, as you're alluding to, made major monumental steps in reversing that finally and overthrowing first off the landed class in Korea in the North Korean countryside, and overthrowing as well the collaborators, the Koreans who were involved in the Japanese military system, in the Japanese police system, bureaucracy, basically the Japanese administration in North Korea. They overthrew these elements. They overthrew the landlords. They really elevated the peasants. This is a thoroughgoing social revolution that happened in a very short space of time.
Women's rights were,
yes, a huge part of it.
Yeah.
Within this sort of post-colonial nation building project, trying to rebuild this nation, get out of this really devastating colonial rule, period of colonial rule against. Coming out of under the yoke of Japanese imperialism, and so yes, this was a lot of change. It was a very dynamic time. One of the really unfortunate things, and as I touched on earlier, Kim Il Sung himself was not, and he too was ruthless in consolidating his own power in the North. What a lot of historians more recently have been pointing towards is more of a middle ground that was really lost in this process of political polarization. Mm. Literally the day after Korea was liberated, after the Japanese Emperor Hirohito on August 15, 1945, announced Japan's surrender to the Allies at the end of World War II, the very next day there were Korean nationalist leaders, both local and more central leaders, all around the country emerged to set up local and national ruling structures, really bottom-up populist sorts of ruling structures that kind of took over the tasks of peace preservation, making sure that retaliation against Japanese colonialists were not too severe. Making sure everything was in order in this very huge time of upheaval coming out of the colonial era. And these were called people's committees in the villages, in cities, all over the country. In South Korea, the United States actually systematically uprooted these people's committees because they thought they were too leftist. They were, in reality, they ranged from nationalist to socialist. Even some communists probably mixed in. It was very diverse in political in terms of political ideology. But the U.S. military occupation that came in September of 1945, they saw them basically as a bunch of communists, and they uprooted them. And these groups were lost. And then in the North, The People's Committees were not uprooted by the Soviet occupation, but in this process of polarization, as the U.S. started to prop the South Korean conservatives, this middle ground, which is really the closest thing to an authentic sort of democratic rule in Korea, coming out of the colonial era in 45 to 1948, these are really began to be lost, and then the North Korean leadership also began to polarize.
So just to punctuate what you're saying, so the Cold War just really meant that there were dynamics that meant a chance for a more moderate, open across the board discussion of what could become the government in both places.
Yeah.
Was lost.
Right, and more people-driven, much more democratic.
We have a caller on the line. Caller, what is your comment or question, please?
Yeah, hi. I'm very interested in this program because I've always been interested in North Korea, and I read probably almost everything that comes out on the subject. And I've got two very simple questions about two somewhat obscure matters regarding the DPRK. I was wondering if you could comment on the cases that involved, I believe it was a translator from Venezuela and one from France, who in the late 70s, I guess for some reason, I mean, they had gone to Pyongyang to help with the translation of publications, but then for some reason they were imprisoned and then ended up in the North Korean gulag for several years until, I guess, it was international pressure that finally set them free. I was wondering if you know any more details about the case of those two individuals. Then my second question is, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but a book came out, I think within the past year or so, a very bizarre account of how the owner of a small Italian restaurant in northern New Jersey became involved in working with delegates of the North Korean mission to the UN, and he himself ended up going to North Korea on some types of bizarre missions for that delegation. So those are my two questions, and I'd be interested in knowing anything that you might be aware of regarding those two cases. Thank you.
And we may be going to some fairly obscure places. I don't know. Are either of those incidents sound familiar to you, Charles?
I'm afraid I'm not familiar with either incident. I think with the late 70s incident, and these are cases that I would actually like to learn more about. But I think one interesting thing to think about is that the 70s were very different from the present. I think even in North Korea, news reporting in this country about North Korea really started to what we know of North Korea, I think, is really post 1994, following the death of Kim Il-sung, following the rise of Kim Jong-il as the head of North Korea. And I think that the 70s were a different time. A lot of kind of kooky things did happen, a lot of different things in the 1970s and 1980s, stunts that the North Korean government tried to instigate or to execute for varying reasons, or in this case, the translators, people who came to North Korea. And things have changed. I think the 50s or the period that John and I were talking about a minute ago, the 40s and the 50s, very different from the 70s and 80s, which are then different from the present. And I think it's useful to keep in mind that these changes do happen, that there are patterns that are worth thinking about, and we're talking about the role of the U.S. and the partitioning of Korea, but then also different changes. But unfortunately, I wish that I could shed more light on those two cases. But
it's going to be a challenge, of course, in the course of an hour to try to fit in 60 years plus of history.
Right.
But let's just try to move the chronology just a little bit forward. We've already alluded to the Korean War as a period, again, that maybe hasn't been a conflict in which the same kind of introspection has been applied to the Vietnam War from American perspective. You were talking a little bit about some aspects of the conflict. I guess, to make some parallels with the Vietnam War, American involvement included heavy bombardment of the North, just as it did in Vietnam, and also, I think, for the first time, the use of napalm. Points should be made that at the end of that war, that both Seoul and Pyongyang, places on both sides of the 38th parallel, were pretty much devastated. But I think we hear the story from the South Korean perspective, perhaps not as much what happened in the North and what happened because of American decisions about how to wage that war. Let me phrase that in terms of a question. So in terms of the impact on a city like Pyongyang and the American aerial bombardment, what was it like to be in Pyongyang and to feel the force of the American Air Force?
It was utter devastation. Saturation bombing, of course, was something that happened in World War II a lot in Europe as well as in Japan. As well as in Vietnam, in the during the Vietnam War, during the Korean War, in terms of land area and population, I don't have exact figures for you, but in terms of the concentration of bombing, of sheer just devastation of North Korean cities, I believe that it exceeded what had happened in, say, in Germany, and was on par. Again, I'm not a military historian. I don't have to know, but it was considerable. It was a very, very concentrated. I think I've seen a figure of about a bomb dropped for every person that lived in Pyongyang. So definite overkill. That many bombs did not need to be dropped.
What I'm remembering is Bruce Cumings' book, and again, assuming an author you'd recommend too. He was instrumental to the course. But again, I think some of the things that he emphasized were just the extremity of the destruction. Also, I think perhaps not an accounting for some of the atrocities that were committed by our South Korean allies in terms of prisoners of war, other things that happened.
Right. And I think these are the big things. Well, okay, too much bombing, bombing of dams, for example, in order to flood agricultural fields. These are military tactics that went against the Geneva Convention. These sorts of things, which are forgotten but should be remembered in terms of U.S. conduct in North Korea. The possibility of germ warfare, not confirmed, but that possibility is out there. And then the napalm that you had mentioned, which is the first time that is used in combat. And this led to a lot of just horrifying incidents that the media just did not cover in the same way that happened 15, 20 years later in the case of the Vietnam War. Things like the My Lai incident or the image of the napalm girl that had happened in the Vietnam War. There are all kinds of U.S. atrocities against not just North Korean civilians, but South Korean civilians as well. U.S. forces not, in a lot of cases, not being able to distinguish between who the enemy was and who friendly civilians were. A lot of unfortunate things happened in that way, the mass killings of civilians, which set patterns, a lot of commonalities with the Vietnam War in that U.S. forces that were sent to Vietnam in a lot of cases did not know who the enemy was, what exactly the political stakes were, why they were there. These sorts of things were happening in the early 50s.
Just to bring this point home, a quote from Bruce Cumings himself, at least known to Americans, was how appallingly dirty this war was, with the sordid history of civilian slaughters, amid which our ostensible democratic ally was often the worst offender, contrary to the American image of the North Koreans as fiendish terrorists. As most Americans don't know, and perhaps don't want to know, truth sometimes as shocking as they are unpalatable to American self-esteem. The other irony here is that the South Koreans, by and large, have taken time in their education system. Anyway, a student in South Korea is critiquing and is studying what happened on both sides of the conflict, and yet that doesn't happen necessarily here in this country. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think in South Korea, there definitely have been, especially after South Korea's democratic transition in 1987, especially in the past 15 years or so, in the 1990s, especially after Kim Dae-jung, the progressive president, was inaugurated in 1998, and there was a nice 10-year period of two of Kim Dae-jung and then Roh Moo-hyun, his successor, to progressive presidents in South Korea. During that period, in this more recent period, there have been a lot of efforts to, both in the education system and among more progressive intellectuals and media and on the blogosphere, to talk about, to rethink this past, and most notably, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was put together in the 2000s. That's still in functioning today, but I think has not been as effective in the under the Lee Myung-bak administration, the conservative administration. So the difference, and the Korean War is a foundational conflict both for North and South Korea coming out of the colonial era. Both governments were really built not solely on the Korean War, but the Korean War is a huge element in it. The Korean War really solidified the conservative South Korean leadership in the 1950s. Had the Korean War not erupted, I think that there's a good chance that the South Korean conservative leadership would not have had the same kind of would have had more problems going forward into the 50s and 60s and into that economic development. On the other hand, I think the North Korean leadership around the figure of Kim Il-sung also very much was solidified around in and through the process of the Korean War.
Yeah.
And so in South Korea, it's only natural that, especially after the end of authoritarian rule in the 1980s, that there would be these efforts to think about it in more critical ways about the Korean War and even the U.S. involvement in the Korean Peninsula.
It's important to also realize that it's not just a technicality, but that the Korean War is ongoing. Conflict, or that sense of conflict and the defensiveness it engenders on both sides, is still an ongoing dynamic. Is that right?
Yeah, it ended in a truce, in a ceasefire in 1953. And so technically, we're still at war with North Korea, as is South Korea with North Korea. I think that in North Korea, it's in a perpetual state of war. And that's something that, in terms of shedding light on the ideology and the ways in which the North Korean media works and the use of images, which we saw a lot with the funeral of Kim Jong-il and the succession of Kim Jong-un, it seems like a real bizarre world. A lot of it, the way in which society works and the way that people think and the propaganda machine works, it centers on this sense of conflict or this embedded conflict. This real it plays on this idea of conflict with South Korea and, more importantly, with the United States, the capitalist and democratic forces in the world, the few, and the sense of crisis of perpetual crisis, or the possibility of things flaring up. And this need for defensiveness, as you touched upon.
Yeah, and one thing we hope to do before the end of the half hour talk is to talk, give people just a little bit of a snapshot of what life is like in the North. Certainly all the dynamics we're talking about that influence a very regimented life, a life in which it's hard to speak out against the powers that be. But conversely, it's still a very human life. It's still a life that's not one that we should demonize, or we should say is somehow less than human. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's such a closed society that all we do, unfortunately, see is most 99% of it are these clips of state media footage of basically propaganda pieces. But there's, it's a complex society. It's a society of 25 million people. There are a lot of layers, complexities to society there, with more and more defectors, North Korean defectors, coming out since the 1990s, over the past 15, almost 20 years. We do get accounts not only of their sheer difficulties and the repressiveness of this very oppressive political system, but also we get these snapshots, these glimpses into what is more ordinary life. I think these are people that they're just people, North Korean people, civilians, and it's easy to lose sight of that when we get all that we're fed are these media clips.
Absolutely. We have another caller on the line. Caller, your comment or question, please.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about the rapprochement that was beginning between the two Koreas in the last years of the Clinton administration, like 96, 97, 98, and then what happened when George W. Bush came into office. Almost the very first thing his administration did in February of 2001 was to dismantle that, to sabotage it. And I think that it's one more aspect of the Bush administration that really hasn't been discussed very much, but I think should be talked about.
All right. Thank you, caller.
That's a great point. I think basically we're looking at 10 lost years starting from the a lost decade, starting with the start of the George Bush administration that the caller just mentioned. Rightly. The real unfortunate thing is, well, at the tail end of the second Bush term, the Bush administration was actually going more towards a conciliatory stance towards North Korea, perhaps realizing that a hardline stance, which he took starting with his Axis of Evil speech in January of 2002, all the way through till about 2006, 2007, just wasn't working. Yeah. And so in the last couple of years, we do see some conciliation. The really unfortunate thing is when Clinton started this in 1994, and one of the key things after Kim Il-sung died, an interesting thing is that the Clinton administration actually extended condolences for the loss of Kim Il-sung, for the death of Kim Il-sung, something that we're not seeing with the Obama administration today, with the passing of Kim Jong-il. And then, as you said, in the mid to late 90s, we see some efforts made by Clinton to get somewhere with North Korea, to take a different approach.
And we're alluding now to the Sunshine Policies, to especially Kim Dae-jung, who had been a freedom fighter in some of the worst days back in the 70s and 80s of fairly tyrannical military regimes in Korea, that we had a coming full circle of both South Korean politics as being more open to democracy and then also more of an opening toward the North in, right. in that time of the 90s.
I was getting towards that, yeah. And under Clinton, even before that, really unprecedented, who would have thought in the 1970s or 80s under Kim Il-sung that the United States would be involved in brokering a deal involving the U.S., North Korea, South Korea, Japan to build two light water nuclear reactors in North Korea to provide petroleum energy to North Korea, which it is and has always been in great need of, and providing food aid to North Korea, which has continued to this day, but really began in the 1990s under Clinton. These are huge steps, things that never would have happened. We could have never imagined back in the days of Kim Il-sung. So this happened, and then as John mentioned, with the inauguration of Kim Dae-jung in 1998 and the starting of the Sunshine Policy, which went on for 10 years under Kim and then Roh Moo-hyun, really huge steps to trying to thaw the relations between North and South Korea. We see the two presidential summits in the year 2000 with Kim Dae-jung and Kim Jong-il, and then I believe in 2007 again with Roh Moo-hyun and Kim Jong-il. Huge changes. Now, the really unfortunate thing is, George Bush came in 2001, 2002. Things really changed and really threw a wedge in this process of possibly positive change. And that went on for most of the 8 years of under George Bush. I think what's even more unfortunate is the inauguration of Lee Myung-bak in South Korea in 2008, who really is a throwback to actually the authoritarian years of 1960s and 1970s in South Korea, of real development, rapid developmentalism, and trying to be anti-communist and use that as a way to rally the country into a more economic-focused agenda. The unfortunate thing under Lee Myung-bak is the Obama administration has really followed the lead of Lee Myung-bak in really surprising ways. And so, in a sense, this is a lost decade, starting from the early 2000s to the present. Had Lee Myung-bak taken a more enlightened leadership, or had Obama, the Obama administration obviously has had his hands full, both domestically and internationally, had North Korea, had it had the ability to take a more independent stance vis-a-vis North Korea, with more independent from the one that was more independent from the Lee Myung-bak administration, we might actually, things might not be so
so retrogressive or moved back the way they have.
So now we're just waiting. We're waiting for the Lee Myung-bak administration to end, and that
is coming up. This there is another election coming up,
right? At the end of this year, the elections, and we can hope for possibly some. And this is, and the thing is, this is such a time of possible change.
Yeah,
I'm not predicting anything, but a time of opportunity where either Lee Myung-bak in the final year of his administration, or his successor, or the Obama administration, on the other hand, could actually do something to, you know, extend some, you know, an olive branch, do something to improve relations.
And we'll talk about that in just a minute. Because I think the point that was made is an important one. The strategy of being hardline and antagonistic toward the North isn't one that's particularly paid dividends. On the other hand, reaching out and in an unconditional way, something that was done during the period of the Sunshine Policy, you know, what was something that was perhaps a little bit more effective? Let's hold that thought. We do have another caller on the line. Call your comment or question, please, for Professor Charles Kim.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I had two more specific questions that, because of my strong interest in DPRK. Could you discuss the geopolitical aspects of the conflict between the two Koreas during the Cold War, particularly in view of the fact that North Korea had the dubious honor of having common borders both with China and the USSR, and how did that influence North Korean foreign policy? And then also, could you discuss the unusual relationship that happens between North Korea and Japan because of the unusually large North Korean community that resides in Japan and that is very active politically? In fact, I believe that's the community from which the people involved in the very interesting account, Aquariums of Pyongyang, that's the community from which they sprung. It's a very influential community in Japan, even though the two countries, Japan and the DPR, do not have diplomatic relations. And I'll take my answers off the air. And thanks again for an interesting program.
Could you repeat the first question? I didn't.
Essentially, you wanted to talk about North Korea, Korea's juxtaposition with the Soviet Union and China, especially the fact that the North shares those borders. Is that right? I think we may have lost him.
Okay.
Actually, it's a very good general point to make that of course, is not just a matter of the Cold War tensions or just the Soviet Union versus the U.S., but China's presence in the area, Japan. Korea is in the center of a maelstrom of all kinds of different competing interests, and that's often had an impact on its history.
I think it makes in the present it makes the accepted framework since about 2003 or 2004, and this happened under George Bush, is a six-party framework. Six parties, a lot of parties.
Yeah.
Six parties are, of course, the two Koreas and the U.S. and China, Russia and Japan. Makes it really difficult to actually get somewhere because of in the present, if you look at China versus the United States, there's already that backdrop is in itself, a huge, constraint in actually, allowing for more face-to-face, open and free talks among the parties involved. Something that really complicates North and South Korean relations or North Korea-U.S. relations is this China-U.S. Competition in the region or even in the world.
And some of this is just that it makes it a tinderbox. It may in terms of the geography is also pretty small area here where all of these different powers have an enacting interest. Certainly a conventional war would have a devastating effect not only on the North and the South, but the surrounding countries. A nuclear war would clearly have a larger effect. So there's a dynamic tension here, is there not, to have all these powers be there trying to prevent things from developing into another conflict?
another conflict or any substantial change. I think people want to move forward very slowly. I think that, I don't think that should there be a conflict. Okay, I think should there be a conflict on the Korean Peninsula, chances are it involve conventional weapons. But should there be a conflict that involves nuclear weapons, then of course that kind of fallout is a major concern. But even without that proximity, with the globalization of the economy, if the economy of South Korea or the region were thrown in some sort of a tailspin, we know that it could have huge implications for not just the region but the global economy. And I think so. That's something. To be honest, I didn't quite understand the question. The caller was asking about the.
He's talking about the presence of North Koreans.
The Cold War era, though.
Okay.
I think. The first question. The second question.
We've got two callers on the line, but if we get to that second question briefly. So, presence of North Korean people in Japan being a significant factor, is that?
I think it's a very interesting thing to look. I'm not sure how important a factor is. There is definitely a very important North Korean aligned population in Japan, and this. Again, is another legacy of the long colonial era, or the important colonial era, following in line with the polarized politics of North and South Korea after 1945, the Korean population, the ethnic Korean population in Japan, also split between pro-North and pro-South lines, and so very interestingly, you see, for example, the establishment of a North Korea-aligned education system that really followed directly in line with the North Korean education system. School kids would learn about Kim Il-sung and this basically North Korean curriculum from the elementary level all the way up to even the university level. There is a North Korean-aligned university in Japan, which is very surprising to see this sort of North Korean education system embedded in this hyper-capitalistic society of Japan. It's still in place. This North Korean education system has, over the years, and especially in the past 10, 15, 20 years, has lost salience, has lost relevance. Things have changed so much that if you learn this kind of North Korean education in Japan, what's that going to do for you in the real world in terms of getting a job and this sort of thing?
Time always flies by. Just give you our 10-minute warning in case there are some points that we want to fit in before the end. But we do have two callers on the line. Caller number one, what's your comment or question, please? Caller, are you there? Yes, please go ahead.
My question had to do with, I don't think you've covered this. I had heard somewhere that it has to do with the long-term viability of the existence of the two separated states. So I had heard in the past that, for example, that most of the industrial capacity originally in Korea was located in the north, whereas most of the food producing and the agricultural capacity had been located in the south. And so I guess my question is the fact that there continues to be famine and a lot of problems with food supply in the north, does that still have something to do with the non-viability of the division of the country into two, or is it strictly as the Western narrative would have it, that it's just the fault of the bad North Korean government and they don't care about people and all this kind of thing? So there's that specific aspect of feeding the country, but also just in general, can we go on for another 50, 100 years with these two separate entities, or is it really something that requires a unification? I mean, Vietnam solved it in one way, and now it's a unified country. So I'm just curious about what he thinks about that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
That's a great question. Thank you, caller. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that the two states could certainly go on indefinitely as separate entities. You're absolutely right. The North is been endowed with more of the mineral resources, it's more conducive toward industrial development, and the South has been endowed with the agricultural capabilities. the relative shortage of agricultural resources in the North is one part of the food shortage in North Korea. The caller is definitely right in pointing out that it's not strictly a narrative in a scenario in which the North Korean government has sort of forsaken the North Korean people and not provided for them. But the North Korean government in the 1970s, 80s, before Kim Jong-il, made a lot of bad policy errors in its agricultural policy, planting corn in the wrong places on hillsides, for example, which contributed to soil erosion and contributed to the flooding in the 1990s that ultimately played a big factor in the famine back then and the ongoing food shortages. There are certain decisions made in the socialist command economy of the pre Kim Jong-il years that continue to haunt the North Korean people and the policymakers who are trying to provide for them. In the end, North Korea probably should not aim for self-sufficiency in agricultural production. And in fact, South Korea, even though South Korea has the best agricultural fields, it actually does not aim for self-sufficiency. It also imports a lot of food. This real fixation on being self-sufficient in food production and in industrial production in North Korea is actually itself a legacy of the colonial era. This is real desire to do it on its for North Koreans to really produce on its own and to produce for itself and to be self-sufficient. It's a fixation that has deep historical roots in the 20th century. And the truth is, North Korea has always imported, you know, resources from different Soviet bloc countries before 1990, and even from the U.S. and Japan in more recent years.
I think this is a good place with our remaining 5 or 6 minutes to maybe reframe our discussion just in terms of talking about the future, what different outcomes could be of the current conflict, the impasse. Yeah. I guess one thing we haven't talked about explicitly is the prospect for eventual reunification. We've made a contrast here with Vietnam, but maybe another apt comparison is with how the two Germanies came together. One point that needs to be made is the economic disparity is much greater than the case of the Germanies. Is that right?
Yeah, disparity is greater. I think South Koreans ever since the East and West Germany reunified, they've watched the German case very carefully, and there's a lot of caution among policymakers and among ordinary people in South Korea. They don't want to move forward too quickly, just knowing that it could be. And in Germany, it's still an ongoing process. It's been over 20 years now.
Yeah.
I think so. There's a lot of caution there. I think the North Korean side, and it touches back to the previous question. I think both sides can go on indefinitely. Even with North Korea's agricultural shortages, they obviously are going to have to find a way to work that out. And it's probably going to involve opening up the economy somehow, more so, or continuing those efforts. In terms of unification, it could happen, but I think that both systems are very resilient and durable. I think the questions of durability go in the United States go more towards North Korea. There's an assumption that it's on the brink of collapse, but I think what we're seeing in after the death of Kim Jong Il, it looks like it's going to just keep going. Mm-hmm. It looks very, very durable and resilient. And in terms of possibility of unification, I think that first off, there needs to be a peace treaty between South and North Korea, and hopefully between the U.S. and North Korea, in order for there to be some modicum of trust to happen and progress to be made.
And one of the recent manifestations of conflict and mistrust and fear has been the sinking of the Chunan, the South Korean ship. But I think there's an argument to be made there, perhaps that's been magnified, amplified by these tensions. One would hope that even in the absence of reunification, relations could get to a point where there isn't this back and forth of propaganda, where there's collaboration, cooperation, short of forming there's lots of things in between, short of forming a unified country that could create a more natural relationship and downscale these tensions, are there not?
Yeah, I think the real trick is to change the lens with which we view North Korea.
Hmm.
And this lens was shaped in the Cold War, and the Korean War was obviously being a huge early moment in the incipient Cold War back then. And you know, the lens hasn't changed that much. I think they're the enemy. They're forever always the enemy, and any wrongdoings are going to be. The assumption is that they start from the North, but I think there are a lot of mistakes that have been made by the South Korean government, by the U.S. government, during the Korean War and also in more recent years. There's a real need to change the lens with which we view North Korea, a real commitment to try to change, a commitment to change, not even a commitment to reunification, but a commitment to make things better. And
does it make sense that this panel, confronting, placing sanctions, all of these negative things haven't necessarily worked? That reaching out and offering a gesture, maybe unconditionally, is something that was working at least for a time in the 90s.
Yeah, to do something extraordinary, to just do something without the sort of suspicion or this idea of tit for tat. What is North Korea? What have they done for us? Or what are they doing with the aid? But not to do it, you know, in a really uninformed or gullible way, but I just think that there's a way to do it in an informed and intelligent and wise way, and to do it with just, I think it involves changing the way with which, simply just changing the way we view the country.
All right. Charles, do you mind sharing your email address just if folks have other questions or follow-up they'd like?
Sure. It's easy. It's ckim45@wisc.edu.
Just one other resource I'd point people toward. We didn't have a chance to talk about this in length, but last year you were able to attend and helped me get together a book reading for a book called More Than Witnesses. It talks about some of the intermediate history, a time when in this case, a group of missionaries are standing up the military government. morethanwitnesses.blogspot.com. It's a place where you can find out more about that.